I discovered that the Shurangama Sutra, the entire text, is online. So, those of you who would like to study the Shurangama Sutra, the entire thing is online. All you have to do is type in Shurangama Sutra and press search, and it'll be right there. Well, we're getting toward the end of the talks on the sutra, so I thought this morning I would pronounce for you the full title of the sutra. The full title of the sutra is, in English, translation, The Summit of the Great Buddha, The Final Meaning of Verification Through Cultivation of the Secret Cause of the Tathagatas and Foremost Shurangama of All the Bodhisattvas' 10,000 Practices Sutra. That is the title. That's actually the title of the sutra. Shurangama Sutra for short. Actually, it's a convention of Buddhist sutras that in the sutra, toward the end, one bodhisattva gets up and says, Buddha, what is the name of this sutra? What should we call this sutra? And the Buddha gives the title. In this case, at the end, when Manjushri asks the Buddha what title, the Buddha gives about five or six different titles, all of which are as elaborate as this one. But this is the one that is actually written on the editions of the Shurangama Sutra. Then I also wanted to return for a moment to the question that Brian raised yesterday, which I've sort of fumbled around trying to tell you about the outflows, because I forgot about the outflow, so I looked it up. The word in Sanskrit is ashrava, or ashrava. In Pali, it's asrava. And outflows is not the literal translation of the word. It's one possible translation. It's also translated as cankers or poisons or intoxicants. The Dhamma Sanghani and the Atasalini Abhidharmic sources list the four asravas as ignorance, sense desire, wrong views, and becoming. So there are different lists, but those are the ones that are given in the most earliest, most classical sources. And these four asravas are likened to intoxicating poisons that cause illness, oozing out around our acts of perception and thought. And Visuddhimagga uses the image of a bucket full of water which has seams that are not tight, so the water is constantly trickling out of the bucket. So that's where you get the term leaking, which is often used in relation to the outflows. When the outflows are activated, which is, you know, all the time, basically, we're leaking. We're leaking out, you know, our storehouse of wisdom and clarity is constantly trickling out. So we're in a state of off balance, not settled. And of course, this image of water and leaking and so on, you know, is eventually, drop by drop, leads to the great flood of birth and death. So, you know, you would hear something like this, our natural response would be, oh, well, I'm going to stop that leaking, you know, it's bad, I shouldn't be doing that. But of course, it's the most natural thing in the world. It's the human being is that which, you know, that the asravas are, that we live in that way, and that this happens is very natural, and there's no one to blame for it other than the sort of upside-down nature of being human, constantly grabbing for something outside oneself to find a sense of completion. Not just in the obvious ways, we all know the sort of more gross forms of that, which we can, if we're lucky, overcome, but in very tiny, subtle, almost literally imperceptible ways in all our acts of perception, as this sutra is emphasizing. There's always leaking in all our acts of perception and thought. And so practice is really the process of, first of all, becoming aware that this is so, and then becoming appropriately dismayed at the fact that it's so. You know, not like freaking out and running around like crazy, but like Yajnadatta, you know, running through the streets of Srivastava shrieking and yelling, but, you know, sort of appropriately dismayed, you know, over the situation of being a human being and it's all its attendant difficulties. And then, out of that wholesome dismay, applying awareness practice, mainly awareness practice, being present with what actually is as it begins to come into view, and understanding how it is, and then little by little learning how to simply be alive to what is as it is, fully alive to it, completely alive to it, without needing anything from it. Just as I was saying yesterday, to listen to the world completely without any leaky grabbiness, and to find out how to live based on that. That's what it really means to go beyond the outflows. So this is, you know, not a small thing, it's a very central point. Now, in original Buddhism, they had language like, dry up the outflows. Guard the mind so that we don't have outflows. So that the goal is that the ongoing flow of life would finally be ended, and there would be the peace of nirvana. That's original Buddhism. That's how the kind of language and kind of feeling. But in Mahayana Buddhism, the same thing is given a little different spin. Because of compassion, because of love, we don't want to feel like we're drying up the outflows. Actually, our effort is to keep on flowing. Not because we're looking for something, because we want something or need something, which would be flowing along in a leaky boat, but wanting to flow along in order to love and benefit others. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them, so I'm keep flowing with sentient beings. So this is another sort of spin on it, but actually it's not different from early Buddhism, from original Buddhism. It's just a little different approach to it, a different way to feel about it or understand it, look at it, but really it's the same thing. Maybe I've told you the story of Ayakema's funeral. Did I tell you about this? Somewhere I was telling somebody that Ayakema, you know, was a dear, wonderful Buddhist teacher who I was very close to and loved deeply. She was a Theravada teacher, and so when she passed away, her funeral was at Green Gulch, and Ajahn Amaro, who's also a very close friend of mine, and I co-officiated at her ceremony. So we both stood up and gave Dharma words, you know, on her passing. And it was very funny because Amaro got up and he said, you know, the outflows are ended, you know, nirvana is entered, no more coming back, finally release and peace. And I got up and said, you know, Aya, you know, you're really great and we love you and we're so glad that we can continue to practice with you forever and ever. And we were both saying the same thing, you know. We were both saying the same thing, each in our own way, each according to our own tradition. It wasn't really different. But somebody listening could have said, geez, are these guys in the same religion or what's going on here? Why are they contradicting each other? But it's not a contradiction at all. It's just different ways for different temperaments And in different language systems, different ways of speaking about essentially the same thing. So, the point of the Shurangama Sutra is that to really and truly dry up the outflows, to be no longer oozing suffering in all the moments of our lives, we need to quiet the mind, cultivate meditation practice, quiet the mind, turn it around, to be able to really understand the spaciousness and the clarity and the ungraspable, undefinable nature of phenomena, non-different from inside or outside. This is the main teaching the sutra is emphasizing. So it's been our effort this week on our cushions to see, to try to see, that even though we can see how the mind so reflexively goes out to grasp for something, that it's deeply the truth that there is nothing whatsoever missing and nothing whatsoever that could be grasped for. And that that reflexive effort is always doomed to dissatisfaction because there's nothing we could ever get that we're looking for. So we need to see that and deeply appreciate that, not once or twice, but many, many times on our cushions. And then getting off our cushions, we have to learn how to live that way, how to conduct ourselves as if that we're really so, because it is. And not to forget about it, to train ourselves to keep that vision of our lives always alive in our activity and not forget about it. To learn how to dance with our lives instead of being resistant in them. So, thanks for bringing up outflows yesterday. Reminding me that I really didn't go into it much before, and it is very important. So as I mentioned several days ago, Nancy was very reassuring that my talks were not too boring and lengthy. They are lengthy, but that they weren't too boring. And most of you have been practicing with the Shurangama Sutra as I've been discussing it and finding it useful, worthwhile. So that's good. I feel good about that. But there are a few who have said, yes, you were right, it really is boring. Oh, jeez. It's been so hard to sit there, you know, through all this long, boring, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's worse than when I was in university and fell asleep in the classes. And then it's so weird, you know. It's not only boring, but it's so weirdly boring, you know. It's weird in a way that I just absolutely can't get into. It's so strange, you know, this is strange sutra. So, you know, this session isn't so bad, but I'm sorry that I have to sit through all this. So I said, well, I'm sorry too. I'm excuse me, and I can't help it, you know, I'm doing this. And it'll be over soon, don't worry. But then I said, however, if you think it's weird, I feel sorry for you because we haven't yet gotten to the weird part. But today, we get into the weird part. And then one more little point here. I'm sort of doing house cleaning, you know, getting a little, all the little points that I forgot to mention that I think are important. And one thing you would notice from all the things that I've been telling you about the sutra, as well as from the title that I just read for you, you know, the title that mentions the 10,000 practices of the bodhisattvas, that this is a sutra that is like a grab bag of a million different things, all kinds of different practices and details, which makes it, you know, rather inelegant. You know, it's sort of all over the map, very cluttered with all these practices and techniques and meditations and so forth. And in China, the Chan school was like that. it had a million practices, very much like Tibetan Buddhism, which you think you heard it all, but then there's a whole other group of practices that you had never heard of before. So many. Now, you know, our tradition comes from Japanese Zen, you know, China to Japan to us. And Japanese Zen started at a time in Japan when there was a big reaction to this distraction of all these different practices. I mean, it's very confusing now, all these practices. You can get distracted. You kind of get into one practice, and then you're, oh, there's a better practice. All the practices are always telling you, this is the deepest practice. So you're doing your practice, and, oh, this is a deeper practice. I better do that, you know, and then do this. So the Japanese thought, this is really crazy and distracting. So during this period, in the Kamakura period in Japan, Dogen's time, all these new schools of Buddhism came, and they all, every one of them, each said, there's only one way to practice this. Only one practice, this is all you do. Of course, everyone had a different one practice that you were supposed to do, but they all had the idea of one practice. So, in Japanese Buddhism, the Shurangama Sutra was not that highly regarded because it was so messy and so full of all these complications. And Dogen, in particular, didn't like the sutra, and when we read every day, I'm conscious we're reading every day the Pukhansa Zengi, which says Zazen is the only practice. And here, the Shurangama Sutra says this and this and this. So that's because Dogen didn't really believe in the Shurangama Sutra, and his teacher, Rujing, thought, along with many other Chinese Zen monks at the time, that the Shurangama Sutra was cooked up in China. It was not really a Buddhist sutra. It was a later concoction. And however, it was pretty much, Rujing was an exception. I mean, there were others who felt this way in China. But pretty much it's an important text in China, and it always was, but it was not an important text in Japan. And that's why you don't hear about it. You may, if you ever read Dogen closely, you'll see references to the Shurangama Sutra as, you know, the work of demons and devils. And, I was reading an essay, you know, today, like a scholarly essay about, you know, is the text authentic or not? It's a debate. And the scholar who was debating, you know, rewriting this essay was a person who is a disciple of Master Hua. So, of course, he was saying, well, you know, it's just as likely to be authentic as not. You know. He sort of, the way they do, they tell you all the arguments for why it's not authentic and then they refute them. But it's not authentic. I don't believe. I mean, if this is not a sutra written in China, there never was one. Maybe there never was one, but I just find it very hard to believe myself. In fact, I'm so absolutely sure of it, you know, just on sort of the basis of the feeling of the sutra and knowing, you know, other sutras that were originally written in Sanskrit. This is really a Chinese sutra. That's what I think. Maybe someday there'll be a text will be discovered in some dusty cave, you know, in Central Asia, proving this to be wrong, but I would be surprised to find that. Anyway, a little footnote, a little point, a side point. Well, maybe you have noticed, maybe it's occurred to you, or maybe not, when you chant the Heart Sutra, how weird it is that the Heart Sutra is going along, you know, no eyes, no ears. And, I mean, that's strange enough, but that's okay. I mean, these are sort of philosophical, metaphysical assertions. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. So it's a litany, literally a litany of Buddhist philosophical or metaphysical propositions, one after the other. Then, all of a sudden, it says, therefore, as if this made perfect sense, therefore, given all this, you should now realize that the Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, the great bright mantra, the utmost mantra, the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and distress. Therefore, you should proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasangate, Bodhisvaha. end of sutra, as if this was like totally followed from all the rest of it. But actually, it makes no sense at all, right? I mean, it's totally bizarre. Like, why would it? So what does that have to do with it, you know? Did you ever think that? It's sort of like, you did think that. Somebody didn't think. It reminds me of, like, I write notes to myself. Like, these are things, you know, like, the notes have a way of disappearing. Did you ever notice how that? Yeah, you see it every day. Like, I have this wonderful function on my computer, like a little notebook that appears on my computer screen, and I can write notes on that, little things that I should do. And I noticed that, like, certain things that I should do that I never do, which are right there on my computer screen, they have a way of, like, disappearing. Like, they don't seem to be there. Even though they're there, I totally don't see them. Right? This, you must know what I'm talking about. Well, that's how it is in the Heart Sutra. You know, you chant this every day, and maybe you just don't see it. But actually, it's very bizarre. And the same thing, like, you see this in almost all sutras. Like, the Diamond Sutra has the same thing, where the Diamond Sutra will be going along, explaining all this about the teachings and so forth and so on. And all of a sudden, they'll say things like, now, all you have to do is, you know, write down one line of this sutra, you know, and put it in a safe place. And if you do that, then all these teachings will be manifest, and you'll have powers will happen, and the whole world will be saved. Just memorize one line. Never mind one line, you know, one word. It goes on like this. How much merit there is in just holding one word, like preserving the sutra, like taking a copy of it and putting it under your bed and leaving it there, you know, carefully. This is better than, you know, $1 million, a gazillion dollars. The sutra says stuff like this. So it's very bizarre, you know, like, well, why? I mean, these people seem so reasonable, you know, in the last page, and now all of a sudden they're saying all this extravagant stuff, and it really is just weird, you know. Why are they saying this magic stuff? So we rational humanist Buddhists, we really enjoy the philosophical parts. So we let the other parts sort of fall into non-existence. We sort of don't notice them. But, you know, insofar as we do notice them, this sort of cultish, magical stuff seems so bizarre. And yet, actually, you really have to, if you think about it, you really have to conclude that Buddhism is this very bizarre and funny mixture of sophisticated, highly sophisticated, philosophical religious teachings about the human mind and heart that are really unsurpassed, you know, in world thought. Not that they're the best, but they're unsurpassed. Others, in other words, others are maybe as good, but none, I think, I really feel, you know, if you really think about it, none goes beyond these beautiful and profound teachings. And yet it's mixed up with this, all this funny cultishness that you, sort of embarrassing, you know, if you're a rational humanist, you know, like, oh, jeez. You know, the word cult is actually, has a bad name now, but it actually means, you know, cult means worship or ritual, magic. Cult is, you know, somehow to enter this magical realm of the world and of experience. And a mantra, like the Heart Sutra's mantra, is, after all, nothing more or less than a magic spell, right? Like, double, double, toil and trouble, only on the good side. And, you know, cult is related to culture and cultivation, right? To take care of the land, to make it produce sort of magically. And if you ever grew a plant from a seed, you know that it's, there's no way to explain this. It's a kind of a, there's an awesomeness in the production out of causes and conditions coming together, but basically out of nothing. How could it be that a tree, you know, huge tree, comes from a little teeny seed? So cultivation and culture come from cult. They originate really in a worshipful feeling about life. Culture is really comes from, you know, a sense of worshipful connection to immense and indefinable powers, and to try to find a way of setting up a human way of living that would somehow be inspired by or in accord with that. That's the origin, really, of culture. So, really, our culture, in its essence, is not really rational or human scale. It's a human analog in its origins for what is far beyond the human mind's ability to grasp. We can only wonder at it. Cults are set up as a form of returning to that sense of wonder and engagement. I was told a few of you that I entered into this sesshin after several weeks of sheer partying. I mean, partying for several weeks because it was Kathy and my 25th anniversary. We've been married for 25 years, so we made a big deal out of it. We went on a big trip, and we had a big party. And we drove. I said, I'll go anywhere as long as I don't have to get on an airplane. So we got in the car and drove to the desert of the Southwest, to the Indian country, which is a really beautiful, haunting landscape. Awesome. The huge deserts, you know, which totally transform into other kinds of deserts after 100 miles. Then another kind, then another kind. Buttes and mesas and haunting rock formations. And it's a very powerful feeling in the mind to be in that landscape. And in ancient times, as we visited some ruins in that part of the world, you can see how people lived in the canyons and in caves, in rock houses. And those people performed rituals and ceremonies, not just for the fun of it, but because they somehow felt a powerful inner compulsion to do so. And their descendants on the same land still do that, insofar as they're able, and they haven't lost their traditions. That's why, the people here did that too, literally. People live on this spot where we're practicing, also had local cults and rituals, and that's why we do that little ceremony over in the corner there of remembering that we're practicing right here on a piece of land that was a holy land and a land of a cult of a people. In large measure, you know, all of us are formed by one way or the other, either in our family background or just by virtue of living here in this part of the world. We've been influenced strongly by the Judeo-Christian tradition, which was originally set up as a reaction to such cults. It's another kind of a cult that is defined as a reactive to those older cults. So wherever Christianity, when it became powerful enough to spread all over the place, one of the first things that it did is sort of root out all these places of cult and get rid of them. Not just sort of tolerate them, but mostly feel obligated to get rid of them. Buddhism also was messianic in this way, spreading all over the world, but when it encountered these cults, instead of feeling some obligation to get rid of them, it said, oh, good, we'll join your cult. So Buddhism, everywhere that it went in the world, always joined the cult of the other people who were already there and sort of said, well, that's just Buddhism. We know about that. And Buddhism sort of built itself around local cults. And in Buddhism, this is essentially, I think, the root of Tantra. Tantric practice is in the ancient human sense about cult, centering around the basic idea. The basic idea of cult is that the ordinary sort of rational, mundane world only looks that way through a powerful act of careful ritual, you transform the ordinary, oppressive world into the eternal, magical world through an act of cult or ritual, using incantation and ceremony. You can effect an alchemical transformation. So, all you have to do is chant Gate Gate, and the whole teaching of the Heart Sutra is manifest. You don't really have to, you know, like study and understand it. All you have to do is chant this mantra with the right attitude and the right circumstances, and then boom, you know, it's all manifested. You don't have to be a scholar of the Diamond Sutra. All you have to do is write down one line and preserve it, and in doing that, in the right way, the whole teaching is manifested. And yesterday we read a passage from the Sharingama Sutra that said something like, the suffering of this world is due only to the six sense organs, and the perfect bliss of awakening is also due only to the six sense organs. In effect, that is the essence of cult, it's the essence of Tantra. All of which is an explanation for the supreme weirdness that we're about to enter into in this sort of ultimate moment of the long journey of the Sharingama Sutra, the tantric part. So most cults of this kind of cult, tantric and otherwise, starts with personal purification. You know, you go and you fast for 7 days, or you go in a sweat lodge for a long time before the ceremony. And the analog of that in Buddhism is the practice of pure precepts. So the next part, after all of that stuff about, you know, Guanyin's cultivation of the practice of pure listening. Remember, that's where we left off yesterday, the practice of pure listening, and an extravagant number of consequences that will come for that. From that, we now sort of go back to earth again to purify ourselves for the tantric ritual by practicing precepts. And the sutra mentions particularly, for some reason, the four precepts that are mentioned are non-lust, non-desire, non-killing, non-stealing, and non-lying. So you have to combine. The previous section was on meditation practice and cultivation. Lest you think that it's all about sitting and cultivating meditation and it's not about precepts, you should know, the sutra says, that you really have to combine the cultivation on your cushion with your careful conduct following precepts in order to approach the ultimate Sharingama teaching. And I'll just give you, I won't go into all of what that it says about the precepts, but it has some interesting language and some, I think, interesting metaphors. Here's what it says about killing, practice of non-killing. Therefore, Ananda, if cultivators of Chan Samadhi do not cut off killing, they are like one who stops up his ears and calls out in a loud voice, expecting no one to hear him. It is to wish to hide what is completely evident. It's an interesting thing to say about the precept of non-killing. It's like little kids who put the blankets over their head, you know, and they think that they're invisible because they put the cover over their head. You stuff up your ears and yell and think that no one will hear you because your ears are stuffed up. So that's not to realize that you have to practice non-killing is like that. And it's true, that's a very good, wonderful image to speak about all the precepts. Not practicing with precepts is to imagine that you're going to put the covers over your head and you'll be invisible, as if your conduct wasn't going to manifest in your life, as if you could just sort of like crash around and do whatever you felt like doing, and it wasn't going to, you know, matter. It's an extremely childish point of view, you know, although it's, you know, the most common thing in the world. Most people think that, you know. But actually, it's quite childish. It's just like a child, really. So, if you wonder why the world is a messed up confusion, it's because everybody in charge is a child. It's like, imagine what would happen if a bunch of children, you know, were probably better off, actually. But that's really what it's like. So anyway, one has to practice the four. And the other thing that's quite interesting is the precept about non-lying. The most important part of that precept is you should not say that you have attained understanding if you haven't. To say that you've attained understanding when you haven't is one of the worst lies that there is. And then Master Hua, in commenting on this, has a very interesting passage where he says that powerful Buddhas and Bodhisattvas never say that they're Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's lying. It's against the law to say so. You should never say anything. And he says, maybe on your deathbed, to certain people, you can intimate. But basically, you never... So he said, that's a sure sign. If anybody ever says they're a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or a great master, he says, that's a sure sign that they're not. It's interesting, yeah. Okay, now we get to the... You ready for this? Okay, here we go. So having practiced all these innumerable samadhis and practice of pure listening, the precepts, and so on. Don't forget, you see, we're kind of sneaking our way slowly up to the Sharangama mantra. Because don't forget, the sutra began in the beginning with Ananda's big problem, remember? That the Buddha had to kind of like free him from by sending a Manjushri to the situation of Ananda just about to leap into bed with Matangi's daughter and apply this secret mantra, which then saved him from that. We forgot about that. It's several volumes ago, but actually, that's the sutra is only all about that mantra. And so now we're about to, after going through all this, you see, to get to the mantra. Now we're ready to get to the Sharangama mantra. So the Buddha said to Ananda, "If there are people in the Dharma ending age who wish to establish a Bodhi Manda, in other words, a place, a physical location on which the Sharangama mantra can be evoked, they should first find a powerful white ox in snowy mountains, one which eats the lush and fertile sweet-smelling grasses of the mountain. Since such an ox also drinks only the pure water of the snowy mountains, its excrement will be very fine." Of course. "They can take that excrement, mix it with chandana, which is a kind of incense, and plaster the ground with it." See? It makes sense, doesn't it? Well, we're trying to, you know, the Sharangama mantra is turning around that which is impure and turning it into purity, so we should find the most pure form of impurity that we can find and smear it all over the ground. That's perfectly reasonable. "If it is not in the snowy mountains, the ox's excrement will stink." So it's telling you, you know, don't think you can just get any ox. You got to get a high mountain. Somebody took me out to a dinner, the most extravagant dinner I've ever experienced in my life, actually. One of the dishes in the dinner was beef from high-altitude cattle. You know, this was amazing, like a little piece, naturally, this big piece of beef. And so you know, we asked, you know, how high? And this was a very high-class, sophisticated restaurant, and the Austrian, the waiters, of course, never English-speaking American waiters, you know. Otherwise, it couldn't be a high-class restaurant. So it was an Austrian man who somehow was highly offended by this question. I don't know why. Anyway, this has to be high. It doesn't say how high up in the mountains, but high. And I guess the way you tell if it's high enough is you smell the excrement. If it stinks, it's not high enough. And you should not smear this excrement on the ground. And in case this happens, you can't. In other words, you might not be able to find. I mean, how many people, you know, raise beef that high up? You know. In case you can't find any, then you have to find a level place, dig down 5 feet or so, and use that yellow earth instead of the ox excrement, which you also mix with chandana incense, sinking in water incense, jasmine incense, continuously permeating incense, burnished gold incense, white paste incense, greenwood incense, fragrant mound incense, sweet pine incense, and chicken tongue incense. I don't know what these incenses are exactly, but probably nobody knows, you know. That's the kind of thing when you're translating, you can never, certain things like this, you can never know what they are. You know, who knows what, you know, 7th century Chinese people were talking about when they were talking about chicken tongue incense. We don't know what that is. Anyway, you should take these 10 ingredients and grind them to a fine powder and make a paste and smear that on the ground of the platform, which should be 16 feet wide and octagonal in shape. In the center of the platform, place a lotus flower made of gold, silver, copper, or wood. In the middle of the flower, set a bowl in which dew that has collected in the 8th lunar month has been poured. Let an abundance of flower petals float on the water. Arrange 8 circular mirrors in each direction around the flower and the bowl. Outside the mirrors, place 16 lotus flowers and 16 censers so that the incense burners are adorned and arranged between the flowers. Burn only sinking in water incense and do not let the fire be seen in the mirrors. It's burning lower. Place the milk of a white ox in 16 vessels, along with cakes made with the milk, also rock candy, oil cakes, porridge, turusha, I don't know what that is, honey, ginger, clarified butter, and filtered honey. These 16 are set around the outside of the 16 flowers as an offering to the Buddhas and great bodhisattvas. At every mealtime and at midnight, prepare a half pint of honey and 3/10 of a pint of clarified butter. Set up a small incense burner in front of the platform. Decoct the fragrant liquid from the turushka incense and use it to cleanse the coals. Light them so that a blaze bursts forth and toss the clarified butter and honey into the flaming censer. Let it burn until the smoke disappears and present it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. About the 4 outside walls, which means the 4 walls outside of the building in which this platform is situated, because it's inside of a building. About the 4 outside walls, you should suspend flags and flowers, and within the room where the platform is located, one should arrange on the 4 walls images of the thus come ones and bodhisattvas of the 10 directions. In the most prominent place, display images of Vairochana Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, Maitreya Bodhisattva, Akshobhya Buddha, Amitabha Buddha, and all the magnificent transformations of Guanyin Bodhisattva. To the left and right, place the Vajra Treasury Bodhisattvas. Beside them, display the Lord Chakra and Brahma, Uchusma and the Blue Dirga, as well as Kundalin and Bhrukti and all 4 heavenly kings with Vinayaka to the left and right of the door, the protector deity. Then suspend 8 mirrors in the space around the platform so that they are exactly opposite the mirrors on the platform. This will allow the reflections in them to interpenetrate ad infinitum. There's a mirror reflecting the mirror, reflecting the mirror, reflecting the mirror. During the first 7 days, so you're now, just you have to set this up, now you have a practice session in this space, which lasts quite a while. During the first 7 days, bow sincerely to the thus come ones of the ten directions, to the great bodhisattvas, and to the names of the arhats. Throughout the six periods of the day and night, continually recite the mantra as you circumambulate the platform. Practice the way with a sincere mind, reciting the mantra 108 times at a stretch. During the second week, so you do that for a week. During the second week, direct your intent by making the vows of a bodhisattva, the four vows that we chant. Do this continually for a week, chanting them. The mind should never be cut off from them. During the third week, so imagine that. Imagine circumambulating this platform with all these mirrors and all this. I mean, picture this, with all the white ox dung smeared all over it, continuously for a week, chanting the four vows. This would certainly rearrange things in your mind. So after a week of that, you would then chant the Buddha's mantra, Bo Da La, for 12 hours at a time, with a single intent. And on the seventh day, this is the seventh day of the third week, the thus come ones of the ten directions will appear simultaneously. And you can bet they would, you know. You can imagine. And when they appear, their light will be mutually reflected in the mirrors and will illumine the entire place, because all these mirrors, you know, imagine, bounce off and really be... And then what will they do? We all know what they'll do. They'll come and they'll rub our head. So we've seen this before, the rubbing of the head, which is... it's all over the world, you know, it's a very strange thing. They have this thing. It's the anointing. Like the king or queen is anointed. Now, in the Western tradition, they're anointed with oil because the oil comes from the deity, the god. So that they're actually being ordained, and their sovereignty is being conferred upon them from above through the agency of this oil. In Buddhism, the Buddha warmly by the warm hand, in a gesture of affection, confers on the disciple this kind of ordination or sovereignty, which is actually done in certain ceremonies. This is actually done, the rubbing of the head. Anyway, that's what happens. The Buddhas appear and they rub the head. Then, after 3 weeks, after all this, one sits upright and still for 100 days. Those with sharp faculties will not arise from their seats and will become shrotapanas, stream enterers. They will enter a definite trajectory toward Buddhahood. Although their bodies and minds have not attained the ultimate fruition of sagehood, they know for certain, beyond exaggeration, that they will eventually accomplish Buddhahood. You have asked how the Bodhi Mandala is established. That is the way it's done. So after the Buddha explains this, Ananda then says, now, thank you very much, and we will certainly do this. But the next thing is that I need you, please tell us, you know, respectfully, O Buddha, tell us the mantra. We're ready now. So then, they all listened single-mindedly as the Buddha proclaimed the spiritual mantra. And then, that's the next thing in the sutra, the spiritual mantra, which is 8 pages long. 8 pages like that of Chinese mantra, which I'm not going to read or pronounce for fear that I'll do it wrong, and I haven't done that all that 100 days of 3 weeks and all this. So, you know, who knows what would happen if I, you know, messed up the Sharingan mantra, so I'm not going to say it out of respect for the mantra and out of my, you know, ignorance. But that's what the Buddha does then, pronounce the 8-page Sharingan mantra. And that is the ultimate moment in the sutra. Then, of course, as you can imagine, follow many, many pages of descriptions of the unbelievable power of this mantra. On and on and on. If I were to explain this mantra from morning till night in an unceasing sound without ever repeating any syllable or phrase, I could go on for as many kalpas as there are sands in the Ganges and never finish. You know, ghosts cannot touch you, nothing can happen to you. You will not be born where there are yakshas, rakshas, putanas, kataputanas, kumbanas, these are all different kinds of ghosts and demons, pishakas and so forth. Where there's any kind of hungry ghost, whether with form or without thought or lacking thought or any such evil place. And throughout this commentary, Master Hua, who was giving this commentary, I think, in the 1970s in California, says over and over again, "You people don't believe in ghosts, do you? But you're stupid, you know. There really are ghosts. And how could you be so arrogant as to not believe in ghosts? Did you ever see a ghost? No, but that doesn't mean there aren't any ghosts. I mean, did Christopher Columbus ever see America before he sailed there? No. Does that mean it didn't exist? Plenty of things that you don't know and see that exist. So why do you go on and on about how there's no such thing as ghosts? So the idea of ghosts and all sorts of demon realms is a very important idea in the sutra, but you don't really have to worry about it once you have the Sharingan mantra, which you can just recite at any time, and everything will be all right. Even if you, you know, commit horrible sins and so forth, the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Vajras, gods, immortals, ghosts, and spirits will not hold it against you if you have this mantra, etc., etc. Then, after all that, it follows then a long reiteration of the key points of the teaching that we've already gone over, and I won't repeat it again. The origin of the world from twisted, false views and so forth and so on. The 7th volume of the sutra, we will now start. But I really am not going to go into it. I'm just going to sort of say that the recitation of the mantra and all this tantric ritual is really the sort of ultimate moment. And then there's a kind of a denouement, which then after this, in the last volumes, all the hell's realms are explained, how they come to be and what they're like. The heavenly realms are explained, how they come to be and what they're like. And then there's the last part is about the 50 skanda, the 50 skanda demonic states, which is probably very important, but we'll skip that part. That is taught. And then this is the ending of the Sharingan Sutra. This is what it says. Ananda, if living beings are able to recite this sutra and uphold this mantra, I could not describe in endless kalpas how great the advantages will be. Rely on the teachings I have spoken. Cultivate in accord with it, and you will directly realize Bodhi without encountering demonic karma. When the Buddha finished speaking this sutra, the bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, upasikas, and all the gods, humans, and asuras in the world as well as all the bodhisattvas, those of the two vehicles, sages, immortals, and pure youths in other directions, and the mighty ghosts and spirits of initial resolve, all felt elated, made obeisance, and withdrew. And that is the last sentences of the sutra. The end. So, then, next. tomorrow, I noticed there's no Dharma talk in the schedule. Is that correct? I think that's right. So, tomorrow morning, we'll have our morning schedule, but since the retreat, the Sesshin, ends at about 11 o'clock, we'll have one last Dharma meeting at 9 o'clock, which will not be a talk, but will be a Dharma assembly. So we'll all convene, and everyone will bring up the teaching together by asking a question. So we'll have, some of you may have experienced this before. It's a traditional ceremony in Zen, Shosan ceremony, Dharma inquiry ceremony. So I wanted to, for those of you who haven't experienced it, I wanted to tell you about it and kind of get you prepared. So what you have to do is present in a ceremonial space a Dharma question. That is your question. Your whatever it is that is most important in your practice, find a way to crystallize it into a brief question that's not discursive, but this is succinct and well put in a line or two. And then I will try to respond to your question by also answering in the same spirit. And then the next person will come and ask a question, the next person, like that. And, you know, the question, just to give you some feeling for how the spirit of this, the question that you would ask truly is your own question, but purified and deepened so that it doesn't appear as just sort of a personal question, but it's, you know, a question coming from the Alaya Vijnana. You know, your question taken to its ultimate essence, so that, like Ananda's question in the sutra, it becomes not just your question, but everyone's question. Everybody's question is everyone's question, if you know what I mean. So do your best to find your question and make it as deep a question as you can for the benefit of everyone. So the ceremony goes rather quickly. It's sort of, we'll go over the form of it tomorrow, I think, because if we go over it now, you'll forget. So tomorrow, right before the ceremony, I think we'll go over the details of how it works. But basically, I'll sit over there and in a chair, I guess, and everybody, there'll be two mats over here. People will come from one at a time, but without any gap. So there'll just be a continuous sea of people coming and asking questions. And you can, it's okay if the answer is incomprehensible or not sufficient to ask a follow-up question. Not like another question, like I had three questions, I'm going to ask them all. But you have one question, and then if the answer seems to require you to ask a further question to clarify, you can do that, maybe one or two further questions if necessary, but often it's not necessary. I mean, maybe it's necessary, but you don't do it. I don't know, but you can. There can be two or three different exchanges, and then when you're finished, you'll go, and the next person will come. And it's like a little bit like assembly line style of bowing and asking and going on, and you have to really speak up so that everybody can hear. So it'll take, I think, less than an hour, 40 minutes maybe. And the way I always think of this ceremony, which most of the time goes very well and is kind of wonderful to do, is I think of it as a kind of like creating out of our 7 days of sitting together, being together, supporting one another, harmonizing together, creating together a kind of group Dharma poem that brings up the essence of what we've studied and what we've experienced all together during this week together. So, you know, you shouldn't feel, I know it's hard to avoid it, but, you know, as much as you can to avoid the feeling of, you know, this is a performance, you're going to show, you're be judged, or, you know, it's not, there's no individual person, it's all together. It's the body of the Sesshin expressing itself. So you should feel in your asking a question supported by everyone and not sort of put on the spot. It's not about putting you on the spot. It's about you, you know, we together have constituted a Dharma assembly. That Dharma assembly makes a picture of Buddha Dharma, and every person here holds a key and crucial part of that picture. And so everybody will bring up that piece of the picture for all of us. So no matter how ignorant and stupid or in a bad mood or you don't like any of this you think you are, still, just come forward and bring up your question. And it will be, you know, part of, I think, something that can be, we can create together that's very beautiful. So do your best. I think that's all I have to say for today. If there are any lingering doubts about the Shirogama Sutra, well, we'll work them through tomorrow.